I will start by saying what a thrill to talk with Terry Gross.
Oh, well, thank you.
You seem so surprised. That reminds me of something. The best interviewers are those who are attentive listeners, and clearly you fit in this category. It reminded me of an address at a public radio meeting you once gave in which you said that perhaps you were a good listener because you thought that everyone else was so much more interesting than yourself.
Yeah, I did say that.
Well, I think there are millions of people who would dispute that now, Terry. With the fame you have, how do you feel being the subject?
Well, it's a little awkward, I go through my life evaluating, how is everybody as a guest? Are they a good guest? Are they a boring guest? Are they a guest worthy of 45 minutes on Fresh Air, or a guest worthy of 10 minutes on Fresh Air? And to suddenly have to measure myself by those standards is very difficult. It's a harsh set of standards to measure up to. When I go about my work as a producer and host, I always have to remind myself that people's value in this world isn't the equivalent of their value as a guest. Like there's a lot of like great painters who aren't great interviewees and so on. There's a lot of people who are like great talkers, but they're really not that great as a musician. So you have to make your peace with that disconnect. But anyways, when the spotlight is on me and when I am a guest, I try now to be as forthcoming as I can so I can measure up. So I can hold myself to the same level that I hold guests to. I try to be forthcoming because that's what I ask of my guests, even if it goes against my nature.
Well, that's one of the things you reveal in the book, that you consider yourself shy.
Shy and reasonably private.
Yeah.
However, I can ask anybody anything on the air. I think a lot of people are like this. I'm like two different people. I think I'm slightly different off the air than on the air. On the air, I'll ask anybody anything. Off the air, I'm more insecure, I'm more shy, more uncomfortable. I'll give you an example. I interviewed Robert Redford on the air. The interview went really well. We were talking about all kinds of things in his life. I went to Sundance because we were doing a couple of interviews from there, and Redford was kind enough to come up to me and take me to his office to talk for a few minutes. And I thought, oh my God, what am I going to talk with him about? Because it wasn't on the air. I didn't have a microphone. So the first thing I said to him was, think it's going to snow tonight?
Oh, you're kidding.
So, yeah. No, I really actually did need to know if it was going to snow because we had a drive back for an interview. And if it snowed, which it was supposed to do, we'd be in big trouble. But
well, that
nevertheless.
That was a pertinent question then.
Yeah, yeah. But
you weren't just talking about the weather.
Yeah, but I was like a different person, I think, in that more informal, non-radio studio setting.
Well, the book provides the opportunity to know you better, not only in a few of the personal things revealed, but also in the interviews you chose to include. What determined your selections?
Well, on the air, the voice is so important. One of the things I really love about radio is that you get an extra dimension than you do on the page. You get the words and you get the voice. And voice communicates meaning, irony, humor. You know how to take what somebody's saying. It also reveals part of their character. Is their voice tense? Do they have a laugh in their voice? Are they a mellifluous speaker? Is their voice musical? You take the voice away, and I was afraid, what are we going to be left with? So one of the standards that we used in determining who made it into the book was, who is a good read? Forget about how they were on the air. Who is a good read? Because we wanted this to be not the scrapbook of the radio show, but rather a book that stands on its own as a book. And so I found that some of the interviews I really enjoyed as radio interviews didn't quite make it as print interviews. And vice versa, some of the things that weren't like brilliant on the air because the person's voice isn't the most mellifluous read really well. So, and then some of my favorite interviews didn't make it in the book because there was so much music involved. Like Sam Phillips, I loved that interview. But when you take away the experience of listening to the records with him and having him comment on those records as we listened, it wasn't substantial enough. So, but I really think that the interviews in the book are good reading experiences.
They are. And, you know, at first I was, I don't want to say skeptical, but I was curious.
I was skeptical at first. This was, no, really, this was one of my real fears about doing the book. Like, who wants to read interviews?
Well, I
you know, but then I found, like, okay, if I work hard enough to find them, they're interviews that really work on the page, and I was so relieved.
Well, it's not only the relief you should feel for how they work on the page, but I think it's a tribute to you as a host that in reading these interviews, your voice just is everywhere throughout, literally your voice. When I was reading the book, I heard you, and I don't know the voices of every person. I was trying to imagine John Updike's voice, but it didn't matter because as in the way you host the show, in reading the book, I was, I guess, completely identifying with you. And your voice spoke for the readers as it does for the listeners.
Well, that's interesting, you know, because one of the things I like about having writers on the show and having them do readings on the show is then when the show's over and I go back and I read more of their work, I can hear it in their voice. I can summon up their voice. And it's funny because what you're saying is that if you know the person's voice, even though it's just on the page, you can add that voice in your head if you want it to be there. And I think that that's true that when you know, say, Samuel Jackson's voice or Nicolas Cage's voice, if you want to be hearing their voice as you read the interview, you can summon up their voice in your mind. It's funny the way that works.
And now I think it will be impossible to think about or see Nicolas Cage without summoning up the image of him chomping on a cockroach.
Yes.
You went into great detail there.
Yes. This is a kind of obscure Nicolas Cage movie called Vampire's Kiss, in which he's a literary agent who thinks he's turning into a vampire. And so it's a very funny movie in which he has his acting's great because he went back and watched the silent version of Nosferatu and incorporates a lot of like the silent movie techniques in it. But anyways, because he thinks he's becoming a vampire, he eats a cockroach, and he did the real thing. So of course I wanted to know, one, like, what it tasted like, and two, did he get sick? Because, you know, I'm a bit of a hypochondriac. If I had eaten a cockroach, I would be going to every doctor in Philadelphia afterwards, getting, you know, looking for rashes and parasites and, you know, rare diseases and so on.
But apparently he lived to tell about it, and it was just a little more protein, huh?
A little more protein, yeah.
In your preface to the interview with the great actress and drama teacher Uta Hagen, you point out the irony of her reluctance to discuss her craft. What was your response when she said it's none of your business?
Yeah, no, she isn't a revered, she was, she died recently. It was a revered actress and acting teacher with two very well-known acting books. So she's all about teaching craft. So I thought, well, obviously, that's what I'm going to talk with her about. So I was stunned when I asked her about craft, and she said to me, it's none of your business. And she explained to me why. She, for her, it's kind of like, you know, if a magician reveals how they pull the rabbit out of the hat, it kind of reveals the trick and ruins the magic. And she also thought, like, when actors talk about the craft, people in the audience think, oh, that sounds easy, I could do that too. And it takes away respect for the ingredient that goes above and beyond that little trick or that little craft. And I respected that, but I explained to her why I think it's important to hear about craft, that as somebody who loves movies and books and music, the more I understand about craft, the more I appreciate a performance. For example, I briefly took clarinet lessons. Now, I never got close to playing well, but by virtue of studying clarinet, I understood how reeds work. I understood how the clarinet is played. I understood all the different colors that the clarinet was capable of. And ever since then, I have heard things in all the woodwinds that I never heard before. And I cherished my lessons, not because it made me a great musician, but because it made me a great listener, or a better listener.
Mm-hmm. Well, with this book, you reveal a good deal about your craft. Was that difficult? Did you feel like you were letting listeners in on how you pulled the rabbit out of the hat?
Well, actually, I have no problem with that. I'm really happy to talk about craft, though. Yeah, and I put in things in the introduction that I hope will answer some people's behind-the-scenes questions about how the show is put together and how I prepare for interviews and how I interact with guests, you know, before and after interviews and things like that.
One of the things that you explain is that most of Fresh Air interviews are conducted by telephone and that you prefer the lack of eye contact.
Well, I know it seems paradoxical, and I'm not sure I necessarily prefer it, but I don't mind that lack of eye contact for several reasons. First of all, if it's an interview where I have to ask challenging questions, it's much easier to ask the tough questions when you're not facing the withering look on your interviewee's face. And also, if you're interviewing somebody famous, it could be really distracting to be sitting across the table from them because, you know, you're used to seeing them on TV or in the movies and you're thinking, oh, they look different, you know, or they're bigger, they're smaller, they're not as handsome, they're more handsome, whatever. And it's just distracting you from the real thing. And also, this is something I've learned, that being in the presence of, like, a celebrity, you know, you might think that the interview is going better than it really is because you're so excited to be in their presence. When I'm doing an interview long distance, it's straight radio for me. I'm just hearing it as an interview, you know? I'm hearing their voice, I'm evaluating as an interview, and I'm not being tricked by the excitement of being in their presence. So I can more clearly evaluate what's interesting, what's not interesting, and what direction I want to head in.
I think that is fascinating because I think many people would consider talking on the phone with Jodie Foster or Michael Caine or Samuel L. Jackson just as intimidating as facing them. But clearly you are in your milieu here if this is all part of the comfort you feel in radio. You mentioned, too, that you think that it's our vulnerabilities that make us more interesting than our strengths. How do you strike a balance between your commitment to the integrity of the interview? You know, you talk about the fact that you like to bring out what is most interesting about the work of your guests, because that's what draws them to us, rather than their celebrity by trying to ask them about their vulnerabilities and their personal thoughts. That must be a difficult line to walk.
Well, I don't want to violate somebody's privacy. I mean, when I'm interviewing an actress or a musician, it's not Watergate. You know, the country's future doesn't depend on me revealing their private moments. So I want them to draw the line between what's public and what's private. I don't want to intrude on anything. At the same time, I want them to be as revealing as possible. And often I'm interested in their weaknesses and vulnerabilities because I do believe that's what shapes us. But it's not like I'm trying to make them uncomfortable. But I think we often, I mean, like for me, I got in radio because I failed at my first profession, which was teaching.
Really?
I would have never stumbled into radio had I not failed as a teacher. I was an awful teacher in many ways, and it was that weakness, it was that failure that led me to find the thing that I really loved.
I think a lot of people are glad that it didn't work out for you as a teacher. With the author...
including my students.
With the author Nick Hornby discussing his book High Fidelity, you mentioned that you and your producer, Danny Miller, identify with the main character's way of judging people by what they cherish, whether it's film, music, books. You call it a taste test.
Yeah.
I was wondering about when you met your husband, who's a very distinguished writer and music critic, did you meet through Fresh Air?
Well, not exactly, though we established our relationship through Fresh Air. He was working before he became a writer, and I met him before he was writing professionally. He worked at a listening store, at a record store. You know, he was one of the many people who get started in bookstores or record stores. So he worked at a record store along with a friend of mine. So I met him at the record store through my friend.
This is sounding more and more like High Fidelity.
but it wasn't a used record store. It was a new record store. That's the only difference, probably. But and I had heard from my friend that Francis, now my husband, had this huge record collection. And Fresh Air at that time was 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. I had a lot of time to fill. And I was looking for regular contributors. And I thought, well, if he has so many records, and probably a lot of those records are rare and out of print, wouldn't it be a fun feature if I got him every week to play some tracks from a rare out-of-print record that we wouldn't have access to, that we'd never get to hear, a jazz record, because he's a, you know, that's what he collects. Mm-hmm. And so I asked him if he would care to audition for something like that. So he wrote me a script that just overwhelmed me. It was so well written. I knew he had a big collection. I knew he was smart. I knew he knew a lot about music. I had no idea he could write that way. Wow. And it was through him doing this out-of-print feature on Fresh Air when it was a local show in 1978 that we started to get to know each other.
Okay, I'm trying to imagine the taste test in this instance. Here's Francis Davis with his vast expertise in so many areas of music. Did you feel like you were on the receiving end of having to pass the taste test? Did you share a lot of lists early on in your relationship?
Well, not really, but we would talk about music and movies and books all the time. And he had listened to the show, so he knew a lot about me through the show. And I mean, we would talk endlessly about all that stuff, but not in list form.
I'm glad.
Unlike High Fidelity.
In the chapter on Charlie Hayden, he says, it's important for bass players to enhance everything behind the solos in order to inspire the other musicians to play better than ever before. That's what I try to do. And Terry, I think that's what you do. I think
thanks.
You inspire all your guests to be their best, and for the listeners in turn to derive what's best about the feature at hand. I also think it's remarkable that it's Francis Davis's quote that prefaces that chapter.
Yeah, you notice that. Well, he's such a good writer. I couldn't help but use his quotes on some things. I mean, because they're so great.
Well, I
admire his writing.
he talks about bass as the most essential instrument, and I couldn't help but thinking in this chapter that, because that quote reminded me of so much of what you do as an interviewer, that he was saying you're essential to Fresh Air, and I think millions of people across the country agree.
Oh, thank you so much.
Well, thank you for talking with me.
Oh, thank you for having me. Lois, those were really good questions.
Oh,
no, those were great. I loved you asking me about, Nick Hornby and High Fidelity. I never get asked that kind of stuff. You really got that interview. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
Thank you a lot for doing it. I really appreciate your questions a lot.
Thank you. All good wishes.